1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, improvement, lean, service design, and sales and marketing. The podcast is sponsored by the Lean Marketing Lab, a learning community dedicated to developing and improving the user experience. Now, to the podcast.
Welcome, everyone. This is Joe Dagher, the host of the Business 901 podcast. With me today is Kim Robertson. Kim is an associate of Value Transformations and co-author of a soon-to-be-released book on configuration management, theory, practice, and application. He started his first company at the age of 18 and has an extensive background spanning 40 years in all aspects of business and aerospace. Kim, thanks for joining me. An introduction just begs the question, what business did you start at the age of 18?
When I was 18, I started a business with wildlife art. I had always been fascinated in very antiquated and antique items where they were covered with inlaid wood, which was known as marquetry, similar to parquet floors. And I wanted to see if I could take it to the next level. And what I did was research not only the wood, but the types of density of cell structure, what happened with it with various different types of finishes so that I could study the refraction and reflection activities going on within the wood and best utilize that for the wildlife art. And starting from contrasting colors of walnut and birch, I ended up at the end of the piece of my career with over 450 different types of wood from all over the world, and pieces were selling for upwards of $3,700. The first piece I sold was for $15. And thankfully, the economy has been what it was over the recent years, and I got a call recently saying that one of these had been resold for $850,000. Even though I'm no longer in the market, they still let me know what's going on with the pictures.
How did that traverse into aerospace and configuration management?
Well, I started out at the University of Utah, ended up with a degree in math and physical sciences. I had dropped out 6 months before getting my degree and went back after the Hunt brothers manipulated the silver market and the bottom fell out of the art market as a result. So I wasn't getting return on my time for doing the work in the marquetry art, and went back to school, finished up. I specialized in finite geometries, and those are mini systems where there are certain rules that control how the system operates. And based upon the work with the marquetry, where I was doing my own marketing, my own supply chain management, my own data management, and assuring the integrity of the pictures themselves by doing the field work for photography in the National Forest up in Wyoming, as well as up in Yellowstone, I decided to see if I could translate all of that knowledge into something else. And so I hired into Martin Marietta at that time, which was working on a program called the MX Missile as a systems engineer, writing the specification for the forward module. That transitioned into a job in contracts, which transitioned into one in finance, and then eventually into supply chain management. And when the savings and loan fiasco happened, I got a job with the Resolution Trust Company, part of FDIC, helping clean up the savings and loan activity as a contracting officer for the feds. I'd always wanted to get into Ball Aerospace, and an opportunity came up there. And so after doing a stint at Rocky Flats, cleaning up the trigger manufacturing site there for radioactivity, as a supply chain manager, I transitioned over to the Ball Aerospace organization, and we started a new arm of Ball Aerospace that dealt specifically with commercial applications. So I was able to bring everything I had to bear in that relationship, knowing the commercial and a little bit about the international market.
So that sounds like you've done a lot of cleanup. Okay, you've got into some things when they were pretty messy.
Yes. it helps to have an organized mind when you do things like that. And the system's perspective of how data flows and what it means to not only the initial design development of a product, but the later rollout and final disposition of the end products, as well as the support that has to happen along the way, certainly has played its part. So I was playing a much larger role than a traditional configuration management person would. Story goes on. We have put up satellites that have worked on, are now giving you all the weather data you have with SNPP. We had satellites that I worked on that measured the ozone depletion, as well as every satellite that Digital Globe currently has on orbit from QuickBird 2 to WorldView 3 were programs that I helped with. So it's been very exciting seeing all of that information come down and being able to orchestrate the back end of it to assure that those who were the creatives, the design engineers and the systems engineers, had the tools at their disposal to do what they needed to do.
Well, tell me, what is your book, your upcoming book, Configuration Management? Can you give me a quick overview?
Configuration management as practiced today deals a lot with EIA 649 and some of the ISO standards, and it's evolved in the U.S. from problems they had during World War II. And I've always thought maybe the backstory is more interesting than that. So I traced things back to about 8,000 years ago in China, where they have hammer mills and mass production. And you may have heard of the terracotta warriors that were put in the ground around 210 BC. And that was the burial site of Qin Shi Huang, of Emperor of China. Well, there they found about 3,000 kilometers apart interchangeable parts in the crossbows. And they also found that after looking at 30,000 arrowheads that they found in the terracotta warriors, that they had a difference in length of only 0.22 millimeters. So this got me curious to say, how many people in configuration management practicing today knows the backstory about everything? So, for example, in the area of computer software, most of that trails back to Boolean algebra. But Boolean algebra tries back to the I Ching with 64 set relationships for who was where in a family structure. And all of these could be represented by ones and zeros, and so then we have the binary language generated out of that for the computer systems that we rely on today. Other things that we had was manufacturing for mass production, not only with the terracotta warriors in 210 BC, but around 256 BC, Carthage was actually giving the same plans for manufacturing of their ships to all of the ports where they traded so they could build the ships on the spot. And if there was damage, replace things like the prow with trunnion and pin type construction, which was totally new. We look at this type of thing and say, well, interchangeable parts of the U.S. is based upon a myth about Eli Whitney. In truth, Eli Whitney's company didn't achieve true interchangeability until years after he died, and people had it long before he did here in the States. He got the idea for interchangeability from a pamphlet that was grabbed by Thomas Jefferson when he was ambassador to France. The history of it is just fascinating. So we start out with the history to ground people in what the terminology is that's used, because terminology today is a mess. Some people say CM is configuration management. Well, if you're in the IT world, CM means change management, and they're totally different. Change management's a part of configuration management. But what really gets people in trouble seems to be in the data area, because we don't do enough interlocking of data and metadata to assure we can get out of the system the information we need. And we ran into that with Resolution Trust Company, where towards the end of it, they asked us how many of the awards we'd made for cleaning up all of these properties that had been repossessed by the banks were awarded to small disadvantage or women-owned businesses, and of those, what was awarded to areas in economic distress. We never had that information requirement up front, so we didn't build it in the system. So without the hooks, we couldn't retrieve it without spending millions of dollars to go back and look at every contract that had been awarded for 6 years.
Your book starts out giving you just a brief overview of some history behind configuration management. It's much more than that. You dive into the configuration of data. You dive into much more because it's certainly just not an airplane book, okay, from what I saw of it, okay?
No, it's not. And the book itself is in a couple sections. The first section is some chapters giving you the background and the terminology and where things came from so that there's a common lexicon of words and definitions and concepts that you can apply later. Then we go into areas that are traditionally seen as configuration management, which is management of the configuration of whatever it may be. It could be a person's configuration. What you got on, what you put on when you woke up today consists of some clothing, a wallet. You know what's in the wallet pretty much. You know how much change is in your pocket. You have a medical history. All of that's your personal configuration. Well, every item that's produced or every item that's developed and not produced has that same type of backstory to it. So we explore how to go about doing that the simplest way based upon some 190 years of experience combined between the people that were involved with doing some of the research with us and comments that we received from groups on LinkedIn and discussions. And it's been fascinating the take different people have on what CM is. So we're trying to explain all of that, not just from an aerospace or a DOD military U.S. government standpoint, but across all of the infrastructure, regardless of what business product-centric piece of the market you're in. We took it from there, and then we described how configuration management activities can support each one of the infrastructure elements, program management, finance, contracts, law, supply chain, your stock rooms, your manufacturing facilities, and all of that. And from there, we go on and say, well, here's some actual examples of things that went wrong. And we end up at the end of the book with all of the configuration management standards that we could find that are applicable today, as well as some of the historical ones. So we were very lucky to have some tie-ins to various governments around the NATO organization, and they were willing to help us with identifying what standards they had before they converted to the SAGNAG NATO standards. And so we were able to put all that together for people for reference within whatever business sector they happen to be. So we've taken it from a basic definition of what it means, how it applies across the enterprise, and then zero in on here's what you can do in different product areas as well as the lessons learned.
One of the parts that jumped out at me was some of the statements, you know, right away that you made in the heading of the poor handling of data. I think you mentioned that 30% of knowledge workers' times are used for looking for data, and even at that, there's only a 50% success rate.
Yes, that's a problem across industry. That one actually came from another book that I got that information from. Basically, we don't have the data linked. So, for example, if you have a subcontract, with the subcontract, you have a purchase order, you have a statement of work, you may have some specifications. After that, you have data that they're going to send to you, which is usually supply chain data lists. Nobody is hooking those together within their product data management or product lifecycle management systems. They can tell you every piece part and who the vendor was that goes in to build up the final item, but they can't tell you where the data was, what the receiving inspection report actually said about the information, or much else. And so that's very bad when you're trying to do any type of quality assessment on why things aren't working the way you thought they would within test before you field something, or in the case of things like the switch that GM had, where did you go wrong with that piece of it? And basically that gets back to one of the premises that if two things don't work the same, aren't of the same quality, don't look alike, don't keep the same number. And we find that that goes on quite a bit. There have been cases of airlines where it's time to replace an engine, and they order a new engine for the jet aircraft. The engine shows up, and it doesn't fit on the wing because they made a change, but they didn't change the top assembly number. And so we have all of those types of activities that we need to take a look at and integrate them together somehow. We have this problem with the lean type activities as well. Lean Six Sigma is something that is very popular right now. Lean Six Sigma, I believe, says you're going to have two bad parts after every million or so. A couple years ago, there was a company that ordered a couple million resistors, all of the same value, from another company, and they had a Lean Six Sigma requirement. And the company they'd ordered from, the supplier, kept saying, well, we're going to have to hold off a couple weeks giving you this last supply data management report. And they said, well, okay. And so eventually the report came in, and there was a shipment of resistors. And there were two resistors typed to this note on top of it saying, we didn't know why you wanted two bad resistors, but it took us 8 weeks to find them. Because they were working at an 8 sigma level, you know. So a lot of that, you have to know what your suppliers are capable of before you levy requirements on them, because otherwise you may be forcing them to do work and costing you money that you don't have to spend.
I think about the data. I think that there's inaccuracies that you point out in the data and the lack of cross-references and coordination between all this data. And from a layman's standpoint, it sounds like here we are back to this old file cabinet thing that anything, you know, 80, 90% of whatever we put in a file cabinet, we never retrieved again. And what we did retrieve, a lot of it was inaccurate. And though that was in the paper world, is data much better?
One advantage you had with the paper world was at least you could retrieve it. What we see a lot with the information technologies activities is that some people make uninformed decisions that the data isn't required, and so they may dispose of it. We've had some cases where I was involved in a program where the decision was made, we're just paying too much for backing up servers. And so we're not going to back up anything after 3 months. We'll back up nightly. We'll back up weekly. We'll back up monthly. We'll save 3 monthlies. And then when we save the fourth, we'll throw the first one away. And lo and behold, an entire program's worth of data went missing. And it happened 4 months or more before it was discovered. And the customer was asking questions because the units were still in the field and nobody could find any of the information. As far as data retention itself goes, I don't think that we're much better because the IT organizations and the programmatics aren't really communicating or understanding, if they are talking, what the actual requirements are. And often it's retention for 10 years after disposal of the last unit, which with an automobile may be 40 years from now, you know. on a space asset. Some of them have been up there 35 years. Voyager's been up there almost 30 years, I believe, and still going. All of that data is still being retained someplace. Which brings us to a secondary problem is what happens because the computers are going and evolving so quickly. And they're talking about possibly having quantum computers now, which would give us something besides binary code because you'd end up with 16 possible states for an answer, making things not black and white or ones and zeros, but shades of gray or technicolor, if you would. So we have some of the missions where we actually archive the computers, the operating systems, the software, and everything else, because 15 years from now, all of that will have evolved and there'll be no way to actually communicate with the spacecraft that was in orbit. The same thing's going on the ground. The last launch of the space transportation system, they were sourcing 086 boards off of eBay to keep the systems running in order to make that last launch because the hardware was so old. And we have the same thing going on with the data. How do you keep it current? And they've been struggling with that for a long time. The portable data format, or PDF, has been a great help with that because PowerPoint and those types of things, when you move them from one server to a lesser cost storage type of retention, sometimes get corrupted and you can't ever retrieve them again. But PDFs still seem to be good.
What's the best way for someone to contact you and learn more about the book, upcoming book?
They could contact me through the Value Transformations website. I can give you that kim.robertson@valuetransform.com. That's valuetransform.com.
They can contact you on LinkedIn also, correct?
Yes, I'm also on LinkedIn. Feel free to contact me. I'm available to answer most questions. I was just helping somebody earlier this morning with questions about what type of product lifecycle management systems there are out there and if there's a preference for one versus the other.
When is the book scheduled to publish?
The book is available now on Amazon.com. And distribution will start in May. And before we go, I wanted to give you the source for where the information came about for the amount of data that is retrieved and how much is valuable. That information is from a book called Data Driven, Profiting from Your Most Important Business Asset, published by the Harvard Business Review Press, and the author is T.C. Redman. It's an excellent book for people that would like to know more about data itself and big data and metadata from a total systems viewpoint.
Well, I would like to thank you very much, Kim. I appreciate it. This podcast will be available in the Business Dino 1 iTunes store and the Business Dino 1 website. So thanks again, Kim.
Thank you, sir.
Visit us at theleanmarketinglab.com. Thank you.